Good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writers Series, Friday, April 20th, 2001. We're talking with poet Eleanor Benedict in preparation for her reading tonight. So welcome to MSU, Mrs. Benedict.
Thank you.
She is here to read from, in part, her collection, All That Divides Us, winner of the 2000 Mae Swenson Poetry Award from the Utah State University Press. For many years, the author has divided her time between Naples, Florida, and Rapid River in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Mrs. Benedict, I know that you are a Tennessee native, so I'm curious about how you came to live in the UP, and what has living in Michigan brought to your writing?
Well, there's a simple answer to how I happen to be in Michigan. My husband works for a paper company, and there's a big paper factory or mill up in Escanaba.
Yes,
so
I'm familiar with that.
I went along.
Well, good, good.
And I think Michigan has brought me a different landscape. Tennessee, of course, has trees, and it has a lot of the same things that Michigan does, but it doesn't have the snow and the ice.
Exactly.
And, I have a love-hate relationship with the snow and the ice. It's beautiful at times, but then I did turn traitor and start going down to Florida as I grew a little bit older. It just felt better down there in January.
Well, good. I can understand that.
Mm-hmm. The landscape. Good. And the other poets. Michigan has a wonderful store of writers.
Yes, we do.
And poets. And I enjoyed meeting some of them. Mm-hmm. And we, for a while in Escanaba, had a writers' conference. So I met a lot of good folks from downstate.
Yeah, and perhaps some MSU faculty.
Absolutely, yes. And some from Ann Arbor, some from Kalamazoo. And
great.
It was great.
Good. I read in Ring Online that back in 1997, the original title of your then-unpublished collection was Paper Flowers, a title shared with one of the poems in your book, All That Divides Us. What made you decide to use the last line of the poem, City of Dust and Water, as the title for your collection?
You're a detective. You've been looking in the bones of this book. Well, I'll tell you, I sent this book out many, many times as a manuscript. To this competition and that competition. Mm-hmm. And as an art person, you know that it usually does take a lot of times to be sent out and tried. And usually winning a competition is kind of a good way to get a good start.
Yeah.
But it's a hard way. But unless you've got lots of friends in the poetry publishing world, mm-hmm. it's the way to go. So I had used Paper Flowers over and over, and it wasn't going anywhere. And I thought, you know, this sounds like a how-to book about how to make flowers. I bet the guys out there think this
okay.
is a handicraft book or something. So then I tried something else in between. I tried Ghost Harvest, and I thought, oh, that's real intriguing. Somebody's going to want that. And then I thought, no, it sounds like Halloween. So I went back over the poems to find something that really was drawing the whole collection together. And I realized that my missionary blood was coming
yes.
out. I do have an impulse to want to bring people together and to find differences and then find likenesses. So I think it was the truer title.
Mm-hmm. I think All That Divides Us is a multi-layered title. I mean, what divided you was not only cultural mm-hmm. differences, but also geographical differences. And of course, many of the poems deal with reconciliation, mm-hmm. and I'll ask mm-hmm. a question about that later.
Oh, you would get an A in any arts course, wouldn't you?
If exactly. Diane comes, you can talk to her about
I
me.
I will.
Now, which, if any, is your favorite poem in the book, and why?
Well, I think I'm very fond of the last poem in the book, because some of the others, many of the others, were sort of, well, here is this event, or this this feeling or this problem, and I'm gonna, you know, here's this poet about this. But the last one, I was looking for a way to conclude this, not to close it up, but to open it out again. And it comes from the drawing, or it's a painting on the front cover.
That's the painting.
And I do own that. I got mm-hmm. it from a Chinese artist who was demonstrating Chinese ink drawings, mm-hmm. but he had this one off in a corner, and it was different. He had added more of himself. It wasn't just the traditional, let's sell this to tourists kind okay. of thing. So I bought it from him. I think he was a little unwilling to let it go, mm-hmm. but it just seemed to open out this whole notion of, first of all, cranes being a great symbol in China for mm-hmm. longevity and eternity. And then we have cranes in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so here again, it was one of these differences yet likenesses. And so I just began kind of looking at the picture, and that the first part comes from how it looks. It looks like a dream. It looks like almost a mysterious nightmare. And then I began to think of Michigan and my own hometown.
Yeah.
And then in the end, I'm thinking about the changes that are happening in China particularly, mm-hmm. and how we're all, in some ways, getting too much alike. We're all building tall skyscrapers yeah. and having tourists and doing this. So there's some reluctance there at the, parting from the old, and yet happiness that, we're on this road together. Yeah. All the cranes are migrating, and we're going with them.
Well, that's a great explanation. In mm-hmm. fact, I think you could almost title that poem or subtitle it for mm-hmm. those who come or for those who dream of cranes as all that unites yeah. us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I noticed, too, the irony that your birthday is June 4th.
That was strange. Yeah. I didn't realize that until I actually got into writing the poem.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, you know, every June now on our television, they show the picture of the little man in front yes. of the tanks. And at the same time, they are showing Martin Luther King's speech for some reason. You know, these mm-hmm. two are history pieces that they run over and over
that
again.
That was a wonderful juxtaposition.
And so it put them together for yes. me. I just have to thank television for that, don't I?
Wonderful. So mass media is good for something.
Yes.
Okay. And speaking of, I guess, uniting us, uniting the different populations mm-hmm. of our countries, I thought to the Chinese people who see the same stars is, again, something along that same line, because, mm-hmm. you know, there are many times when I look at the stars, I mean, particularly when I'm up north and in the
yes.
dark with no city lights
yes.
to distract or detract from the stars, I think of all the millions of people in the world who can see them at that very moment.
And, you know, I have to confess something
yes.
here. I wrote this poem before I went to China,
oh,
and it
really?
Wasn't named this then. It was named, it was just Sight.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been looking, coming home at night, looking at the lake and the black darkness and the reflections and seeing the stars and mm-hmm. how they almost looked like they were standing up, like the sky was up straight. And it's just a little poem. It's kind of an imagistic thing, maybe a little bit like some of the Chinese and Japanese imagery poems, and so
yes.
do you want me to read it? I will.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So later I titled it, To the Chinese People Who See the Same Stars. Lake Michigan lies flat in the dark, a black pool wide as a prairie. The sky stands perpendicular over the water's body. Its tall onyx multiplies the harbor lights into a millennium of seeing. The clockless house of the hunter, the queen in her jeweled chair, the two bears eating, drinking, pouring the everlasting cup.
That was very nice, thank you. I'm glad you were able to get that in during the interview. Now, I thought one poem in part three of your collection was very different from the others, which primarily dealt with your personal experiences as a tourist in China. I'm curious to know just what inspired you to write Sylvia Plath in China.
Well, somebody on the train in the group I was traveling with had a New Yorker magazine with Janet Malcolm's story, kind of a review or a rehashing of mm-hmm. Sylvia Plath's tragic life, and she had a kind of a new twist on it. Sylvia didn't come off very well. She was kind of arrogant and mm-hmm. demanding and strange, and maybe her husband, Ted Hughes, the poet, was not so bad after all.
Yeah.
And I was reading this, and someone on the train said, oh, well, you know, I went to school with her.
Oh, wow.
Maybe it was her magazine. I don't remember now. I might have made that part up. But anyway, it just occurred to me, of course, Sylvia Plath was never in China.
Right.
And I just thought, well, what if she were? Mm-hmm. What if she were sitting right where I am? And it was just kind of a poem that came quickly and was rather easy to write. But I've always felt close to her, as many young women and old mm-hmm. women, too, have felt, because she was writing about the time I was just beginning. And mm-hmm. before I ever got published with poetry, I had a short story that was in an anthology along with one of hers. So I've always felt like, well, I'm almost like Sylvia. I've got one in the same magazine.
Do you consider this to be almost a found poem then, by sheer luck?
Well, you know, it could be. I hadn't really thought of it that no. way. And I did kind of write it in cold blood, which I don't usually. I don't usually do that. I usually worry over an idea or something that bothers me, and it turns into a poem. And this one, I just sort of thought, oh, what if?
Yeah. Well, I wondered, you know, with the last part of it, if you know how you came upon that criticism that she wouldn't be immortal if she hadn't died so young and tragically.
Well, it might be a cheap shot.
well, no, not if the
but I think
was
really
critical.
That, you know, you think even of Keats and Schubert and some of the great artists who died so young and yet made big achievements.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some who have lived maybe too long. I don't want to name any names, but so really, I think that does add to the mystique of Sylvia Plath, this tragedy that she had. And I suspect, well, I know that, in fact, she was a victim of manic depressiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And this great ups and great downs is a feature of that. If she had had lithium or medicine or whatever and had not had these great ups, some of these last poems that she has written or wrote were, I would say, psychotic, really. But they're great, and you know, would she have written those if she was going to a good old doctor and had a nice old husband? I don't know.
I don't know. That's true. Uh-huh. In fact, I think we have time. If you would like to read it, please, that would be great.
Sylvia Plath in China. How did you get here, big blonde with X-ray eyes? On the train from Jinan to Chufu, you climb out of a slick magazine brought by an old classmate of yours from the States who wants a place in the gossip. Today you wear a new mask, cold and arrogant, no longer pitied for your faithless husband, your lone frenzy, two little children left to find bread and milk instead of mother. If you had lived, maybe you'd ride this train as a gray-haired grandma with children in your billfold, scribbling your latest volume since the Pulitzer, with a kindly second husband dozing at your arm. Green fields of rice blur by. You smile at hyperbole in a teacup. The house you'll return to is warm, ordinary, with all the conveniences you missed. If your immortality didn't depend on misfortune, mania, and death at an early age, squeezing genius out of your brain like grapes pressed to thorns and sour wine, we could welcome you home.
Thank you very much. Now, several of the poems in All That Divide Us touch on Christianity, to being meeting our Chinese cousins and the guest chair at Nankai University. How important is faith in your life, and has religion always been a major theme of your work?
Well, I think so. I come from a family of a few rascals, but some preachers and indeed missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think my beliefs now, if they were compared to some of the early preachers in my family, would be quite different. Because I'm interested in many different religions, but I am a Christian, and that is very important to me. I'm not grabbing people by the shoulders and saying, you've got to be a Christian in this book at all.
No.
But it just seems that the imagery and the echoes from the mm-hmm. scriptures that I grew up with, and particularly the story of Pentecost, just really haunts me, especially in this book, because it's about people of different cultures, different languages, and how it's so difficult sometimes to understand each other, and yet we do have this single flame of life together. And so I think that's really what it means in this book. I'm not trying to sell anything. In fact, the character who is in this book, my aunt, Grace is her name, sort of lost faith when she was in China because she saw what she thought was a lot of Western influence that was really perhaps exploited. If they just, she didn't feel that really many Christians that she knew were doing the way they should. So she, I would say, in here, as I say, she throws her Bible away. She didn't literally, I don't think, but in fact, she really, it stayed with her, I think. But she figuratively did throw her faith away.
Yeah, I know in one of the last poems you make reference to hoping that she is saved. So,
yes, that was one really painful thing. I think in the last section I realized how much my father is really in this book. It's ostensibly about her, about his sister, but it's really about my relationship with my father, I think, in many ways, and also with my daughter. My daughter is in here, too. So.
Yes, I noticed it in City of Dust and Water in particular. Well, thank you for that. I noticed that you do explore, you know, the monasteries and the monks. You make reference to many times in other poems. So again, religious themes are something that can unite us and not necessarily divide us. Now, many of your poems do deal with reconciliation, particularly those in the last section, as you just mentioned. Do you feel that you've made peace with your family, if you had to make peace with them, and particularly your father?
Yes, I do. I never really felt that I had fallen out, as we say in the South, with my father. But I didn't realize my own, actually I was jealous of this Grace, the sister, because he spoke of her so often. And I thought, well, think of me, you know, me, just like a little kid. So I just feel like I've grown up in this book. This is sort of what it's about, partly, too.
And it took you many years to get there.
Yes.
So that's almost
and
comforting.
Actually,
to know.
I do write about other things besides China.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
good. But in this book, it's China, and I think I've kind of done that now.
Yes. Your poem, Where It Hurts, is specifically about your father always telling you how you looked like his sister.
You look just like my sister Grace, he said.
Rather than defining
you
as
just like you.
Rather than defining you as an individual.
Yes.
Okay. I was wondering too if you would pronounce your aunt's full name, please.
Oh. Grace Divine Lou.
Yeah, Lou. That's what I thought was Lou.
But it's a very common name. Lots of people are named that. But she felt that she was, in fact, she was a Chinese citizen after many things happened between our countries' relationships.
Yes.
And that was really the great silence between the families was when the Korean War and then all that happened after that, the McCarthy era here, made it very difficult for any communications. And there was silence for 20 years before we heard from her again.
Wow.
And it was our silence almost more than hers.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that at the end of her life, at least she came back.
Yes, she did. She came back.
And you were able to reclaim your past.
Yes,
and she was able to really reclaim hers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love her name, Grace Divine Lou. That's poetic in and of itself.
Yeah.
I was wondering, too, if you've sent copies to of All That Divides Us to your cousins in China.
My cousin Willie, his name is, and there's a poem here to him too called Storyteller because it's really his story, and he has in fact written this story of his mother in prose. It's available in a book called Grace in China, and it's quite interesting. It has letters and interviews and all kinds of documentary, but very personalized kinds of writing from her own pen in many cases. We found her letters under my mother's bed, which sounds strange. My mother had kept all of these letters.
Oh,
and,
good.
There they are.
Well, they're a wonderful treasure trove for your
family. I'm a great friend of Willie's. We're almost brother and sister now. He is in Canada teaching Chinese people and Japanese and others from the Far East who are coming to the West to change their homes, and he's helping them with a program to acculturize them.
Great. Great. Your aunt has certainly been a real literary star then as the subject
yes,
of your
has.
Poems and then her son's biography. That's wonderful. And on a slightly different topic now, I just want to take a moment to touch on your founding editorship of the literary journal Passages North. In your foreword to the Passages North anthology, published in 1990, you wrote, "Perhaps the 90s will bring a touch less dour isolation, a dash more wit, and a breath more air than Charles Baxter saw in Passages North's first decade." Do you think that the 1990s did prove better for the arts in the upper Midwest, and particularly the upper peninsula? And if so, how?
Well, at the first of the 1990s, there was a big sinking of the arts, and I don't want to get too political here. But they were politically involved and were used, I think, as a whipping boy, the arts were. That was before your time, perhaps. For a while, the NEA particularly was accused of doing this, that, and the other that they shouldn't. But really, the NEA fellowships and their support of literary activities, I think, are responsible for really boosting the arts in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then after this little slump that we've had, I think they are really quite alive and healthy, and in Michigan, I think, are doing quite well. So the Michigan Council for the Arts became the Michigan Council for Arts and Culture, Cultural Affairs. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the same thrust, and so perhaps nothing but a little bit of time and sweat, blood, and tears helped fix that, and I think we're doing quite well. And it's amazing how many young people are coming up and publishing poems and writing novels, and all the rest.
Good, I'm glad. And then lastly, what writing projects are you currently working on, and can we expect another poetry collection from you anytime soon?
Oh, I hope so. I hope it doesn't take quite as long as this one. I'm really trying to put together poems now that I kind of put aside when I was working on all of these Chinese things. I think it's going to be called Waiting for News, and that's one of the poems that's probably going to be towards the beginning of the book. It's mostly about the way the natural world impinges on human relationships, and I guess I'm kind of a nature person when it really gets down to it, but a people person too, so I think there is a linkage there, and I think that's what it will be, and I hope it gets out there before
I
die.
So well, yes, that would be really nice. I look forward to that, and hopefully it will be out there.
And by the way, Passages North is still living, alive and well, and doing well at Northern Michigan University under the editorship of Katie Hansen. So.
Great. Thank you for that plug. Okay. I'm sure she'll appreciate it, too. Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Benedict, for your participation in the MSU Libraries Michigan Writer Series.